symptoms with Ghosh's explanation. His mouth turned up. He was laughing.
You knew what I had as soon as I told you, right, Doctor? Before you did all these other things?
I suppose I did.
So, will this twist untwist by itself?
No. It has to be untwisted, surgically.
It's common, you say. My countrymen who get this, what happens to them?
At that moment, Ghosh connected the face with a scene he wished he could forget.
Without surgery? They die. You see, the blood supply at the base of the loop of bowel is also twisted off. It's doubly dangerous. There's no blood going in or out. The bowel will turn gangrenous.
Look, doctor. This is a terrible time for this to happen.
Yes, it is a terrible time,
Ghosh burst out, startling Mebratu.
Why here, if I may ask? Why missing? Why not the military hospital?
What else have you understood about me?
I know you're an officer.
Those clowns, he said, nodding his chin in the direction of his friends outside. We don't do a good job of dressing as civilians, Mebratu said wryly. If their shoes aren't spit-polished, they feel naked. It's more than that, actually.
Years ago, shortly after I arrived here, I saw you conduct an execution. I'll never forget that.
8 years and 2 months ago. July the 5th. I remember it too. You were there?
Not intentionally.
A simple drive into the city had turned into something else when a large crowd on the road had forced him and Hema into being spectators.
Please understand, it was the most painful order I ever carried out, Mebratu said.
Those were my friends.
I sense that,
Ghosh said, recalling the strange dignity of both the executioner and the condemned. Another wave of pain traveled over Mebratu's face, and they both waited till it passed.
This is a different kind of pain, he said, trying to smile.
You should know, Ghosh said, that earlier today the palace called. They asked matron to inform them if a military person came here for treatment.
What?
Mebratu swore and tried to sit up, but the movement made him yell in pain. His companions rushed in.
Did matron tell the palace? He managed to ask.
No. Matron told me she wouldn't turn you away knowing that you had nowhere else to go. The patient relaxed now. His friends had a quick discussion and then they remained in the room.
Thank you.
Thank matron for me. I am Colonel Mebratu of the Imperial Bodyguard. You see, we had plans, a few of us, to meet on this date in Addis. I came from Gondar. When I got here, I found the meeting had to be called off. We feared we were compromised. But I didn't get the message till I was already here. Before I left Gondar, yesterday, my pain began. I saw a physician there. Like you, he must have known what I had, but he told me nothing. He told me to come back and see him in the morning, and that he wanted to check me again. He must have told the palace, or else why would they call the hospitals in Addis? Hanging will also be my fate if I am discovered in Addis. You must treat me. I can't be seen at the military hospital today.
There is another problem, Ghosh said. Our surgeon has...
He has left.
We heard about your... loss. I am sorry. If Dr. Stone can't do it, then you have to.
But I can't.
Doctor, I have no other options. If you don't do it, I die.
One of the men stepped forward. With his light beard, he looked more like an academic than a military man.
What if your life depended on it? Could you do it?
Colonel Mebratu put his hand on Ghosh's sleeve.
Forgive my brother, he said, then smiled at Ghosh as if to say, You see what I have to do to keep peace? Out loud, he said, if something should happen, you can say in good faith that you knew nothing about me, Dr. Ghosh. It's true. All you know about me are all the things you guessed.
Ghosh dialed Hema's quarters. It occurred to him that Colonel Mibratu and his men might have been plotting some kind of coup. What else could the secret meeting in Addis have been about? Ghosh was faced with a conundrum. How did one treat a soldier, an executioner, who now was engaged in treason against the Emperor? But of course, as a physician, his obligation was to the patient. He felt no dislike for the colonel, though he could do without the brother. It was difficult to dislike a man who bravely suffered physical pain and managed to retain his manners. Over the hum of the receiver, Ghosh could hear the blood rushing into his ear with every heartbeat. Hema's brusque hello told him she was scowling. It's me, he said. Do you know who I have here tonight? He told her the story. She interrupted before he could finish. Why are you telling me this? Hema, did you hear what I just said? We have to operate. It's our duty. She wasn't impressed. He added, they're desperate. They have nowhere else to go. They have guns. If they are so desperate, they can open the belly themselves. I am an obstetrician gynecologist. Tell them I just had twins and I'm in no condition to operate. Hema! He was so mad that words would not come out. At least in the business of patient care, she was supposed to be on his side. Are you minimizing what I have on my hands? She said. What I've gone through just yesterday? You weren't there, Ghosh, so now these children's every breath is my responsibility. Hema, I'm not saying. You operate, man. You've assisted him with Volvulus, haven't you? I've never operated on Volvulus. By him, she meant stone. The silence was punctuated only by the sound of her breathing. Does she not care if I get shot? Why take this attitude with me? As if I'm the enemy. As if I caused the disaster she walked into when she returned. Did I invite the colonel here? What if I have to resect an anastomous large bowel, Hema? Or do a colostomy? I am postpartum, indisposed, out of station, not here today. Hema, we have an obligation to the patient, the Hippocratic Oath. She laughed, a bitter, cutting sound. The Hippocratic Oath is if you are sitting in London and drinking tea. No such oaths here in the jungle. I know my obligations. The patient is lucky to have you, that's all I can say. It's better than nothing. She hung up. Ghosh was an internal medicine specialist through and through. Heart failure, pneumonia, bizarre neurological illness, strange fevers, rashes, unexplained symptoms, those were his métier. He could diagnose common surgical conditions, but he wasn't trained to fix them in the operating theatre. In Missing's better days, whenever Ghosh popped his head into the theatre, Stone would have him scrub and assist. It allowed Sister Mary Joseph Praise to relax, and for Ghosh, being the first assistant to Stone was a fun change from his routine. Ghosh's presence transformed the cathedral hush of Theatre 3 to a carnival racket. And somehow Stone didn't seem to mind. Ghosh asked questions left and right, cajoling Stone into talking, instructing, even reminiscing. At night, Ghosh sometimes assisted Hema when she did an emergency C-section. Rarely, Hema sent for him when she performed an extensive resection for an ovarian or uterine cancer. But now he found himself alone, standing in Stone's place, on the patient's right, scalpel in hand. It was a spot he hadn't occupied for many years. The last time he stood on the right was during his internship when, as a reward for good service, they let him operate on a hydrocele while the staff surgeon stood across and took him through each step.
On his instruction, the circulating nurse passed a rectal tube into the anus, guiding it up as high as it would go.
"We better start," he said to the probationer who was scrubbed, gowned, and gloved on the other side of the table, ready to assist him. Her faint pockmarks were hidden by a cap and gown. Even though her lids were puffy, she had beautiful eyes.
"We can't finish if we don't start, so we better start if we're to finish. Yes?"
A very large incision should be made. Of small ones in such cases, be afraid. The coil brought out, untwisted by a turn, a clockwise turn, as you will quite soon learn, and then a rectal tube is upward passed, thereon there issues forth a gaseous blast.
With the colon swollen to Hindenburg proportions, it would be all too easy to nick the bowel and spill feces into the abdominal cavity. He made a midline incision, then deepened it carefully, like a sapper diffusing a bomb. Just when panic was setting in because he felt he was going nowhere, the glistening surface of the peritoneum, that delicate membrane that lined the abdominal cavity, came into view. When he opened the peritoneum, straw-colored fluid came out. Inserting his finger into the hole and using it as a backstop, he cut the peritoneum along the length of the incision. At once, the colon bullied its way out like a zeppelin escaping its hangar. He covered the sides of the wound with wet packs, inserted a large Balfour retractor to hold the edges open, and delivered the twisted loop completely out of the wound onto the packs. It was as wide across as the inner tube of a car tire, boggy, dark, and tense with fluid, quite unlike the flaccid pink coils of the rest of the bowel. He could see the spot where the twist had occurred, deep in the belly. Gently manipulating the two limbs of the loop, he untwisted, clockwise, just as Scope said. He heard a gurgle, and at once the blue color began to wash out of the ballooned segment. It pinked up at the edges. He felt through the bowel wall for the rectal tube that Nurse Asqual had inserted. He fed it up like a curtain rod in a loop. When the tube reached the distended bowel, they were rewarded with a loud sigh and a rattle of fluid and gas hitting the bucket below. "And down the coil contracts, and you will see the parts arranged more as they ought to be," Ghosh said, and the probationer, who had no idea what he was talking about, said,
"Yes, Dr. Ghosh."
Ghosh flexed his gloved fingers. They looked competent and powerful. A surgeon's hands. You can't feel this way, he thought, unless you have the ultimate responsibility. After he closed, as he was stripping off his gloves, he saw Hamer's face in the glass of the swinging doors. It disappeared. He charged after her. She ran, but he soon caught up with her in the walkway. She stood panting against a pillar.
"So?"
she said when she could speak.
"It went well?"
They were both grinning.
"Yes, I just untwisted the loop."
He couldn't hide the pride and excitement in his voice.
"It could twist again."
"Well, his choice was either me or nothing, since the other doctor here would not help."
"True. Good for you. I've got to go. Almaz and Rosina are watching the babies."
"Hema?"
"What?"
"You would have helped if I got into trouble?"
"No, I was just stretching my legs."
Despite herself, a twinkle showed in her eyes.
"Silly, what did you think?"
With Hema, even sarcasm felt like a gift. He fought the instinct to jump forward, the eager puppy, too ready to forget the cuffing it had received minutes before.
"Just yesterday," Hema said, "I drove past the spot where we saw that first hanging, and I thought about it."
She seemed to study him meditatively.
"Have you eaten anything today?"
That was when he noticed. His beloved, his Madras-returned unmarried beauty, was more magnified than ever.
There were succulent rolls visible between sari and blouse. The skin under her chin was gently swollen like a second Mons.
"I've not eaten since you left for India," he said, which was almost true.
"You've lost weight. It doesn't look good. Come by and eat. There's food, tons of it. Everybody keeps bringing food."
She walked off. He studied the way the flesh on her buttocks swung this way and that, about to sail off her hips. She'd brought back from India more of herself to love. It was the worst time for this, but he was aroused. He dressed and found himself thinking about the operation again. Should I have tacked the sigmoid colon to the abdominal wall to prevent it twisting again? Didn't I see Stone do this? Colopixy, I think he called it. Had Stone spoken to me about the danger of a colopixy and warned against it, or had he recommended it? I hope we took out all the sponges. Should have counted once more. I should have taken one more look. Checked for bleeders while I was at it. He recalled Stone saying, when the abdomen is open, you control it, but once you close it, it controls you.
"I understand just what you mean, Thomas," Ghosh said as he walked out of the theater.
It was late evening before the hospital staff gathered by the gaping cavity in the earth, now shored up with timber. There was no time to waste because by Ethiopian tradition, no one eats till the body is interred. That meant the nurses and probationers were starving. The casket arrived on the shoulders of orderlies, treading the same path down which Sister Mary Joseph Praise would come to sit in this grove. Hema trailed behind the pallbearers, walking with Stone's maid, Rosina, and with Ghosh's maid, Almaz, the three of them taking turns carrying the two infants who were bundled up in blankets. They laid the casket down by the edge of the grave and removed the lid. There were sobs and strangled cries as those who had yet to see the body pressed closer. The nurses had dressed Sister Mary Joseph Praise in the clothes the young nun first donned when she pledged body and soul to Christ, her bridal dress. The arching hooded veil was to show that her mind was not on earthly things, but on the kingdom of heaven. It was the symbol of her being dead to the world, but in the gathering mist it was no longer a symbol. The starched gimp around her neck hung down like a bib. Her habit was white, interrupted by a plaited white cord. Sister Mary Joseph Praise's hands emerged from the sleeves and met in the middle, the fingers resting on her Bible and a rosary. Discalced Carmelites originally shunned footwear, hence the term discalced. Sister Mary Joseph Praise's order had been practical enough to wear sandals. Matron left her feet bare. Matron chose not to call Father De La Rosa of St. Joseph's Catholic Church, because he was a man who had a disapproving manner, even when there was nothing to disapprove, and there was plenty here. She almost called Andy Maguire from the Anglican Church. He would have been a comfort and most willing. But in the end, Matron felt that Sister Mary Joseph Praise would have wanted no one but her missing family to see her off. The same instinct led Matron to ask Gebru earlier that day to prepare to say a short prayer. Sister was always respectful of Gebru, even though his being a priest was incidental to his duties as watchman and gardener. She would have appreciated how much it honored and consoled Gebru to be called on in this fashion. In the cool and very still air, Matron held up her hand. "Sister Mary Joseph Praise would have said, 'Don't grieve for me. Christ is my salvation.' That must be our consolation as well." Matron lost her train of thought. What else was there? She nodded at Gebru, who was immaculately dressed in a white tunic extending to his knees, trousers underneath, and tightly coiled turban on his head. These were the ceremonial clothes he wore only on Timkat, the day of Epiphany. Gebru's liturgy was an ancient biblical gies, the official language of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. With great effort, he kept his sing-song recitation short. Then, the nurses and probationers sang Sister Mary Joseph Praise's favorite hymn, one she had taught them and which they favored in the morning chapel in the nurses' hostel.
Jesus lives. Thy terrors now can no longer, death, appall us. Jesus lives. By this we know thou, O grave, canst not enthrall us. Alleluia. They all pushed forward, straining for a last look before the lid was nailed in place. Gebru would say later that Sister Mary Joseph Praise's face glowed. Her expression was peaceful, knowing her ordeal on earth was over. Almaz insisted that a lilac scent emerged as the lid went down. Ghosh felt a message being conveyed to him. Sister seemed to be saying, "Make good use of your time. Don't waste your years pursuing love that might never be reciprocated. Leave this land for my sake." Hema, standing close, vowed silently to Sister Mary Joseph Praise that she'd look after us as if we were her own. With ropes under the casket, the coolies lowered Sister into her grave. The heavy stones required by Ethiopian tradition were handed down to the taller coolie, whose feet were perched on either side of the coffin. The stones were to keep hyenas out. At last, the two men pushed the earth back to fill in the grave, the service all but over. All but the ululations. Shiva and I, so new to life, were startled by that unearthly sound. We opened our eyes to contemplate a world in which so much was already amiss.
Chapter 14. Knowledge of the Redeemer. The day after the funeral, Ghosh rose early. For a change, his waking thoughts were not about Hema, but about Stone. As soon as he was dressed, he went straight to Stone's quarters, but he found no sign that the occupant had returned. Deflated, he went to Matron's office. She looked up expectantly. He shook his head. He was eager to see his post-operative patient and check his handiwork. He'd been a reluctant surgeon, but now the anticipation he felt was a revelation to him. It must have been a feeling Stone had regularly enjoyed. "This could be addictive," he said to no one in particular. He found Colonel Mebratu sitting on the edge of the bed, his brother helping him dress. "Dr. Ghosh," Mebratu said, smiling like a man without a care in the world, though he was clearly in pain. "My status report. I passed gas last night, stool today. Tomorrow I will pass gold." He was a man used to charming others, and even in his weakened state, his charisma was undiminished. For someone fewer than 24 hours out of surgery, he looked great. Ghosh examined the wound, and it was clean and intact. "Doctor," the colonel said, "I must return to my regiment in Gondar today. I can't be gone for much longer. I know it's too soon, but I don't have a choice. If I don't show my face, I will be under even deeper suspicion. You don't want to save my life only for me to be hanged. I can arrange for intravenous fluids at home, whatever you say." Ghosh had opened his mouth to protest, but he realized he could not insist. "All right. But listen, there is a real hazard of the wound bursting if you strain. I'll give you morphine. You must travel lying flat. We'll arrange intravenous fluids, and tomorrow you can sip water and then clear liquids the next. I will write it all down. You will need the stitches removed in about 10 days. The colonel nodded. The bearded brother clasped Ghosh's hand and bowed low, muttering his thanks. "Will you travel with him?" Ghosh said.
"Yes, of course. We have a van coming. Once he is settled, I'll go to my new posting in Siberia.
Ghosh looked puzzled.
I am being banished.
Are you also in the military? Ghosh said.
No. As of this moment, I am nothing, Doctor. I am nobody.
Colonel Mebratu put his hand on his brother's shoulder.
My brother is modest. Do you know he has a master's degree in sociology from Colombia?
Yes, he was sent to America by His Imperial Majesty.
The old man wasn't happy when my brother was attracted by the Marcus Garvey movement. He didn't let him pursue a PhD. He summoned him back to be a provincial administrator. He should have let him finish.
No, no, I came willingly, the brother said. I wanted to help my people, but for that I am off to Siberia.
Ghosh waited, expecting more.
Tell him why, the colonel said. It's a health matter, after all.
The brother sighed.
The health ministry built a public health clinic in our former province. His Imperial Majesty came to cut the ribbon. Half my budget for the district was consumed to make everything look good along His Majesty's route. Paint, fences, even a bulldozer to tear down huts. As soon as he left, the clinic closed.
Why?
The budget for the clinic was spent.
Did you not protest?
Of course, but no replies to my messages. The health minister intercepted them. So I reopened the health center myself. It took about 10,000 birr. I got a missionary doctor in a town 50 miles away to come once a week. I had a retired army nurse doing dressings, and I found a midwife to move there. I got supplies. The local bootlegger gave me a generator. The people loved me. The health minister wanted to kill me. The emperor summoned me to Addis.
How did you get the money? Ghosh asked.
Bribes. People would bring over a big injera basket with more money in it than injera. When I used the bribes for a good purpose, they gave me more bribes because they were worried that I would expose them.
You told this to His Majesty?
Ah, but this is complicated. Everyone is whispering in his ear. Your Majesty, I said when I got my audience, the health center needs a budget to keep going. He acted surprised.
He knew, the colonel injected.
He heard me out. Those eyes give away nothing. When I was done, His Majesty whispers to Abba Hanna, the minister of the purse. Abba Hanna scribbles in the record, and the other ministers, have you seen them? They are in a state of constant terror. They never know if they are in their master's favor or not. His Majesty thanks me for my service to that province, etc., etc., and then I bow and bow and walk backward. I meet the minister of the purse at the rear of the room, and he gives me 300 birr. I need 30,000, or even 300,000 I could use. For all I know, the emperor said 100,000, and Abba Hanna decided it was worth only 300. Or was 300 the emperor's idea?
And who do you ask?
By then, the next petitioner is telling his story, and the minister of the purse is running back to take his position near the emperor. I try to shout from the back of the room, Your Majesty, did the minister make a mistake? My friends dragged me away.
Otherwise you wouldn't be around to tell us this story, the colonel said. My foolhardy brother.
The colonel turned serious, his eyes on Ghosh as he took Ghosh's hand in both of his.
Dr. Ghosh, you're a better surgeon than Stone. A surgeon in hand is worth two who are gone.
No, I was lucky. Stone is the best.
I thank you for something else. You see, I was in terrible pain all the way from Gondar to here. The journey going back is going to be easy by comparison. The pain was... I knew whatever this was would get worse, would kill me. But I had options. I came to you. When you told me that for my fellow countrymen, if they have to suffer this, they simply die, The colonel's face turned hard, and Ghosh could not be sure if it was anger or if he was holding back tears. He cleared his throat. It was a crime to close my brother's health center. When I came to Addis Ababa for this meeting with my colleagues, I was prepared to listen, but I wasn't sure. You could say my motives were suspect. If I wanted to be part of a change, was it for the best reasons or just to grab power? I'm telling you things you can never repeat, Doctor. Do you understand? Ghosh nodded. My journey, my pain, my operation, the colonel went on. God was showing me the suffering of my people. It was a message. How we treat the least of our brethren. How we treat the peasant suffering with volvulus. That's the measure of this country. Not our fighter planes or tanks or how big the Emperor's palace happens to be. I think God put you in my path. Later, when they had left, Ghosh realized how he'd been so predisposed to dislike Colonel Mibratu. But the opposite had happened. Conversely, as an expatriate, it was easy to project benevolent qualities onto His Majesty. Now he was less sure. Mr. Elihu Harris was dressed all wrong. That was the first thing Matron noticed when he closed the door behind him and stepped up to her desk and introduced himself. He had every right to be annoyed, having visited missing on the two previous days without meeting Matron. Instead, he seemed grateful to see her, worried about intruding on her time.
"I had no idea you were coming, Mr. Harris," Matron said presently. "Under any other circumstance, it would have been a pleasure. But you see, yesterday we buried Sister Mary Joseph Praise."
"You mean..." Harris swallowed hard. His mouth opened and closed. He saw such sorrow in Matron's eyes, and he was embarrassed to have overlooked it.
"You mean... the young nun from India? Thomas Stone's assistant?"
"The very same. As for Thomas Stone, he has left. Vanished. I am very worried about him. He is a distraught man."
Harris had a pleasant face, but his overdeveloped upper lip and uneven front teeth left him just short of handsome. He fidgeted in his chair. He was doubtless yearning to ask how all this had happened, but he didn't. Matron understood he was the sort of man who, even when he had the upper hand, didn't know how to press for his rights. As he stood before her, his soft brown eyes reluctant to engage, her heart softened to him. So Matron told Harris everything, a rush of simple sentences that were weighed down by what they conveyed. When she was finished, she said,
"Your visit comes when we are at our worst."
She blew her nose.
"So much of what we did at Missing revolved around Thomas Stone. He was the best surgeon in the city. He never knew that it was because of the people he operated on in the royal family, in the government, that we were allowed to go on. The government makes us pay a hefty annual fee for the privilege of serving here, can you imagine? They could, if they want, simply close us down. Mr. Harris, even your giving us money was because of his book. This might be the end of Missing."
As Matron talked, Harris sank farther back in the chair, as if someone had a foot on his chest. He had a nervous habit of patting his cowlick, even though it was not in danger of falling. There are people in the world who were cursed by bad timing, Matron thought. People whose cars break down on the way to their wedding, or whose Brighton holiday is invariably ruined by rain, or whose crowning day of private glory is overshadowed by and forever remembered as the day King George VI died. Such people vexed the spirit, and yet one was moved to pity because they were helpless. It wasn't Harris's fault that Sister had died or Stone had disappeared. Yet there he was. If Harris wanted an accounting of money, she had nothing to show him. Matron submitted progress reports under duress. And since what donors wanted to spend on had no link to the reality of Missing's needs, her reports were a form of fiction. She'd always known a day like this would come. Harris choked, then coughed. When he recovered, with much throat clearing and fumbling with his handkerchief, he came indirectly to his business with Matron. But it wasn't what Matron imagined it would be.
"You were right about our plan to fund a mission for the Oromo, Matron," Harris said.
Matron faintly recalled a mention of this in a letter.
"The doctor in Wolo sent me a telegram. The police have occupied the building. The district governor will do nothing to evict them. The supplies are being sold. The local church has been preaching against us, saying we are the devils. I had to come to straighten things out."
"Pardon me for being blunt, Mr. Harris, but how could you have funded it sight unseen?" She felt a pang of guilt as she said this, since Harris hadn't seen Missing till now. "If I recall, I wrote to say that it was unwise."
"It's my fault," Harris said, wringing his hands. "I prevailed on my church steering committee."
"I haven't told them yet," Harris said, almost in a whisper. Clearing his throat and finding his voice, he added, "My intentions, I hope the committee will understand, were good. I hope to bring knowledge of the Redeemer to those who do not have it."
Matron let out an exasperated sigh.
"Did you think they were all fire worshippers? Tree worshippers? Mr. Harris, they are Christians. They are no more in need of redemption than you are in need of a hair straightening cream."
"But I feel it's not true Christianity. It's a pagan sort of," he said, and patted his forehead.
"Pagan? Mr. Harris, when our pagan ancestors back in Yorkshire and Saxony were using their enemy's skulls as a plate to serve food, these Christians here were singing the Psalms. They believe they have the Ark of the Covenant locked up in a church in Axum. Not a saint's finger or a pope's toe, but the Ark. Ethiopian believers put on the shirts of men who had just died of the plague. They saw in the plague a sure and God-sent means of winning eternal life, of finding salvation. That," she said, tapping the table, "is how much they thirsted for the next life." She couldn't help what she said next. "Tell me, in Dallas, do your parishioners hunger like that for salvation?"
Harris had turned red. He looked around as if for a place to hide. But he wasn't completely done. Men like him became stubborn with opposition because their convictions were all they had. "It's actually Houston, not Dallas," he said softly.
"But Matron, the priesthood here is almost illiterate. Gebru, your watchman, doesn't understand the litany he recites because it's in Gias, which no one speaks. If he holds to the Monophysite doctrine that Christ had only a divine nature, not a human one, then..."
"Stop, Mr. Harris, do stop," Matron said, covering her ears. "Oh, how you vex me."
She came around the table, and Harris drew back as if he worried that she might box his ears. But Matron walked to the window.
"When you look around Addis and see children barefoot and shivering in the rain, when you see the lepers begging for the next morsel, does any of that monophysitic nonsense matter the least bit?"
Matron leaned her head on the window pane.
"God will judge us, Mr. Harris, by..."
Her voice broke as she thought of Sister Mary Joseph Praise.
"By what we did to relieve the suffering of our fellow human beings. I don't think God cares what doctrine we embrace."
The sight of that plain, weathered face pressed against the glass, the wet cheeks, the interlocking fingers. It was for Harris more powerful than anything she had said. Here was a woman who could give up the restrictions of her order when it stood in the way. From her lips had come the kind of fundamental truth which,
because of its simplicity, was unspoken in a church like Harris's, where internecine squabbling seemed to be the purpose for the committee's existence, as well as a manifestation of faith. It was a small blessing that an ocean separated the doers like Matron from their patrons, because if they rubbed shoulders, they'd make each other very uncomfortable. Harris stared at the stack of Bibles by the wall. He hadn't seen them when he first walked in.
"We have more English Bibles than there are English-speaking people in the entire country."
Matron had turned from the window and followed his gaze.
"Polish Bibles, Czech Bibles, Italian Bibles, French Bibles, Swedish Bibles. I think some are from your Sunday school children."
"We need medicine and food. But we get Bibles." Matron smiled.
"I always wondered if the good people who send us Bibles really think that hookworm and hunger are healed by scripture. Our patients are illiterate."
"I am embarrassed," Harris said.
"No, no, no, please. People here love these Bibles. They're the most valuable thing a family can possess. Do you know what Emperor Menelik, who ruled before Haile Selassie, did when he fell ill? He ate pages of the Bible. I don't think it helped. This is a land where paper, Wolketu, is much valued. Did you know that among the poor, marriage consists simply of writing two names on a piece of paper? And to divorce, why, you just tear up the paper. Priests will give out pieces of paper with verses on them. The paper is folded over again and again until it is a tiny square, and then these are wrapped in leather and worn round the neck. I was happy to give away Bibles, but the interior minister saw it as proselytizing.
How can it be proselytizing when no one can read? Besides, it is the same faith as yours, I said.
But the minister disagreed. So now the Bibles pile up, Mr. Harris. They breed in the tool shed like rabbits. They spill over into our storerooms and into my office. We use them as support for bookshelves, or to paper the walls of the chica huts. Anything at all, really.
She walked over to the door and beckoned him to join her outside.
Let's take a walk, she said.
Look, Matron said when they were in the hallway, pointing to a sign above a door. Operating Theatre 1. The room was a closet, jammed full of Bibles. Wordlessly, she pointed to another room across the way, which Harris could see was a storeroom for mops and buckets. The sign above it read Operating Theatre 2.
We have only one theatre. We call it Operating Theatre 3. Judge me harshly, if you will, Mr. Harris, but I take what I am given in God's name to serve these people. And if my donors insist on giving me another operating theatre for the famous Thomas Stone, when what I need are catheters, syringes, penicillin, and money for oxygen tanks so I could keep the single theatre going, then I give them their operating theatre in name.
At the steps of the missing outpatient department, the bougainvillea was in full bloom, concealing the pillars of the carport so that the roof appeared to be cantilevered. A man hurried by, bundled in a heavy white wrap over a ragged military overcoat. His white turban and the monkey mane fly swish in his hand made him stand out.
"That's the very Gebru we were talking about," Matron said, as Gebru spotted them and stopped and bowed. "Servant of God, and watchman, and one of our bereaved."
Harris was surprised at Gebru's relative youth. In one of her letters, Matron wrote of a Harari girl of 12 or 13 who had been brought in, moribund, a cut umbilical cord trailing out from between her legs. She had given birth a few days before, but there had been no afterbirth. The placenta wouldn't budge. The family had travelled by mule and bus for 2 days to get to Missing. And as Gebru, in his compassion, lifted the poor girl out of the gharry, she screamed. Gebru, instrument of God, had inadvertently stepped on the trailing umbilical cord, causing the placenta to break free.
The little girl was cured even before she crossed the threshold of the casualty room. Harris shivered in a sleeveless cotton shirt, his eyeballs oscillating, his fingers tugging at his collar, then adjusting a pith helmet which Matron didn't realize he had with him. Matron walked him through the children's ward, which was no more than a room painted bright lavender with infants on high beds with metal rails. The mothers camped out on the floor beside the beds. They jumped up at the sight of Matron and bowed.
"That child has tetanus and will die. This one has meningitis, and if he lives, he might well be deaf or blind. And its mother," she said affectionately, putting her arm around a waif-like woman, "by staying it missing night and day, is neglecting her three other children. Lord, we've had a child back home fall into a well, get gored by a bull, and even kidnapped while the mother was here. The humane thing is to tell her to go home, to take the child home."
"Then why is she here?"
"Look at how anemic she is. We are feeding her. We give her the child's portions, which the child can't eat, as well as her portion, and I've asked them to give her an egg every day, and she is getting an iron injection and medicine for hookworm. In a few days, we'll find her bus fare, and then send her home with this child, if he is alive. But at least she'll be healthier, better able to look after the other children. Now this child is awaiting surgery."
In the male ward, which was long and narrow and held 40 people, she kept up her recitation. The patients who could tried to sit up to greet them. One man was comatose, his mouth open, his eyes unseeing. Another sat leaning forward on a special pillow, struggling mightily to breathe. Two men, side by side, had bellies swollen to the size of ripe pregnancy.
"Rheumatic heart valve damage, nothing we can do. And these two fellows have cirrhosis," Matron explained. Harris was struck by how little it took to nurture and sustain life. A huge chunk of bread in a chipped basin and a giant battered tin cup of sweetened tea. That was breakfast and lunch. Very often, as he could see, this feast was being shared with the family members squatting by the bed. When they emerged from the ward, Matron stopped to catch her breath. "Do you know that at this moment we have funds for 3 days? That's all. Some nights I go to sleep with no idea of how we can open in the morning."
"What will you do?" Harris asked. But then he realized he knew the answer. Matron smiled, her eyes almost disappearing as her cheeks pushed up, giving her a childlike quality.
"That's right, Mr. Harris. I pray. Then I take it out of the building fund, or whatever fund has money. The Lord knows my predicament, or so I tell myself. He must approve the transfer. What we are fighting isn't godlessness. This is the most godly country on earth. We aren't even fighting disease. It's poverty. Money for food, medicines, that helps. When we cannot cure or save a life, our patients can at least feel cared for. It should be a basic human right."
Harris's anxiety about the steering committee had all but gone.
"I'll confess, Mr. Harris, that as I get older, my prayers aren't about forgiveness. My prayers are for money to do his work."
She reached out for his hand and held it in both of hers, patting it.
"Do you know, dear man, that in my darkest moments, you have so often been the answer to my prayers?"
Matron felt she had said enough. It was a gamble. She had nothing to put on the table but the truth. Chapter 15. Crookedness of the Serpent. The newborn seemed unreal to Ghosh, all noses and wrinkles, as if they'd been planted in Hema's house, a lab experiment gone awry.
Ghosh tried to make appropriate noises and act interested, but he found himself resenting the attention they were getting. It was 5 days since Sister Mary Joseph Braze's death. He had stopped by Hamer's house in the early evening before setting out to look for Stone. He'd found his Almaz there, very much at home, immersed in the task of caring for the babies, barely registering his presence. The last few days, he had been forced to make his own coffee and heat his own bathwater. Matron, Sister Esquale, Rosina, and several nursing students were there too, fussing over the newborns. Rosina, with nothing to occupy her now that Thomas Stone was gone, had also moved over to Hamer's. No one noticed when he left Hamer's bungalow. He drove first to the Gyan and the Ras hotels, then to the police headquarters where he sought out the sergeant he knew. The man had no news for him. He drove through the piazza from one end to the other and then, after a beer at St. George's, decided it was time to go home. His plans to leave had solidified. He had an airline ticket to Rome, then on to Chicago, leaving in 4 weeks. By that time, perhaps things at Missing would have settled. He couldn't see himself staying on, not now, not with Stone gone and Sister dead. But he had yet to find the courage to tell Matron or Almaz, or Hamer. It was dark when he pulled into his carport. He saw Almaz squatting by the back wall, wrapped against the cold so only her eyes showed. She was waiting for him, just as she had the night Sister Mary Joseph Braze had died.
"Oh God, what now?"
She came to the passenger door, yanked it open, and climbed in.
"Is it Stone?" he said. "What happened?"
"Where have you been?" "No, it's not Stone. One of the babies stopped breathing. Let's go to Dr. Hamer's bungalow."
The blue nightlight made Hamer's bedroom seem surreal, like a set for a movie. Hamer was in a nightdress, her hair loose and flowing over her shoulders. He found it difficult to look away. The two newborns were on the bed, their chests rising and falling evenly, eyes closed and their faces peaceful. Turning back to Hamer, he saw she was trembling, her lips quivering. He put his hands out, palms up, asking what had happened. By way of an answer, she flew into his arms. He held her. In the years he had known her, he'd seen her happy, angry, sad, and even depressed, but underneath, always feisty. He had never seen her fearful. It was as if she'd become some other person. He tried to lead her outside of the room, his arm still around her shoulder, but she resisted.
"No," she whispered, "we can't leave."
"What's going on?"
"I happened to be looking at them just after I put them to bed. I saw Marion breathing evenly, but Shiva," she sobbed now, as she pointed to the child with the dressing on his scalp. "I saw his stomach rise, then it went down as he exhaled. And then, nothing. I watched as long as I could. 'Hema, you are imagining things,' I said. But I could see him turning blue, even in this light, especially when I compared his color with Marion's. I touched him, and his arm shot out as if he was falling, and he took a deep breath. His fingers curled around my finger. He was saying, 'Don't leave me.' He was breathing again. Oh, my Shiva, if I hadn't been standing there, he'd be gone by now."
She sobbed into her hands, which rested on his chest. Ghosh held her, her tears making his shirt damp. He didn't know what to say. He hoped she didn't smell the beer. In a moment, she pulled away, and they stood arm in arm, Almaz just behind them, gazing at Shiva. Why had Hamer taken on naming of the babies? It felt premature. He couldn't get his lips around the names. Were the names negotiable? What if Thomas Stone showed up? And why name the child of a nun and an Englishman after a Hindu god? And for the other twin, also a boy, why Marion? Surely it was temporary, until Stone came to his senses, or the British Embassy or someone made arrangements. Hamer was acting as if the kids were hers.
"Did it happen more than once?" he asked. "Yes, once more. About 30 minutes later, just when I was about to turn away, he exhaled and stopped. I made myself wait. Surely he has to breathe. I held back until I couldn't stand it any longer. When I touched him, he started breathing as if he'd been waiting for that little push, as if he forgot. I've been here for the last 3 hours, too scared to even go to the loo. I didn't trust anyone else to watch, and besides, I could not quite explain it to them. Thank God Almaz decided to stay to help me with the night feeds. I sent her to get you,
Emma said. Go ahead, he said. I'll watch them. She was back in no time.
What do you think?
She said, leaning against his arm as she dabbed her eyes with a hanky.
Shouldn't you listen to his lungs? He wasn't coughing or struggling.
Ghosh, finger to chin, his eyes narrowing, studied the child quietly. After a long while, he said, I'll examine him thoroughly when he is awake, but I think I know what it is. The way she looked at him made his heart swell. This wasn't the Hema who reacted to everything he said with skepticism. In fact, I'm sure. Apnea of the premature. It's well described. You see, his brain is still immature, and the respiratory center, which triggers each breath, isn't fully developed. He forgets to breathe every now and then.
Are you sure it isn't something else?
She wasn't challenging him. Like any mother, she wanted certainty from the doctor. He nodded. I'm sure. You were lucky. Usually apnea is fatal before anyone recognizes it.
Don't say that. Oh, God. What can we do, Ghosh?
He was about to tell her that there was nothing one could do. Nothing at all. If the child was lucky, it might outgrow the apnea in a few weeks. The only choice was to put these preemies on machines that breathed for them till their lungs matured. Even in England and America, this was rarely done. At missing, it was out of the question. She waited for his pronouncement. She had suspended her own breathing. Here is what we do, he said, and she sighed. He was making this up. He didn't know if his plan would work. But he knew he did not have the heart to say there was nothing to be done. Get me a chair, one of those from the living room. Also, give me some of your anklets and a pair of pliers, and some thread or twine, a clipboard or a notebook if you have one. And tell Almaz to make coffee, the strongest she can make and as much of it as she can make, and tell her to fill up the thermos flask. This new Hema, the adoptive mother of the twins, rose at once to do his bidding, never asking why or how. He watched her dance away. If I knew you were that agreeable, I'd have asked for a cognac and a foot massage as well, he muttered to himself. And if this doesn't work, at least I'll have my bags packed. Ghosh sat in the chair, sipping coffee, a string wrapped around his finger and the house silent around him. It was 2 in the morning. The other end of the string connected to one of Hema's anklets, which he'd cut in half and looped around Shiva's foot. The tiny silver bells dangling from the anklet made a pleasant, cymbal-like sound when the foot moved. He had strapped his wristwatch to the arm of his chair. On the first page of an exercise book, he made vertical columns labeled with date and time. Shiva stirred in his sleep, the anklet sounding reassuringly. Earlier they had fed the twins, adding one drop of coffee to Shiva's bottle. It was Ghosh's hope that caffeine, a nervous system stimulant and irritant, would keep the respiratory center ticking. It had clearly made the infant more restless than his identical twin. Hema slept on the sofa in the far corner of the living room, which was just beyond this bedroom. A floor lamp with a shade that they moved to Hema's room gave him light to see the page. Ghosh studied the walls. A little girl in pigtails and a half-sari stood between two adults. A framed picture of Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, handsome and pensive, one finger on his cheek, hung opposite Ghosh's chair. He'd imagined Hema's bedroom would be neat, everything in its place. Instead, there were clothes spilling off the bed rail, a suitcase open on the floor,
more clothes piled in the corner, and books and papers stacked on a chair. And just inside the bedroom